Thank you. Okay, hi, hello everybody. So I'm going to start with this story. If you were to look at the infant mortality rate for the past 250 years in a country like Sweden, you would find that the infant mortality rate used to be very high. 2 children out of 5 did not make it till the age of 4. So, but then if you look at everybody here, your parents, your grandparents, your great-great-grandparents, all the way back 250 years, some of them may live in Sweden, some may live in a different country that had a similarly high infant mortality rate, but you would find that none of your ancestors died before the age of 4. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. So there's a special property of the lineage, of the whole life history of an individual that's different than the population average. So similarly, what I do in my lab is that I look at bacteria. This is E. coli bacteria. And I can subject them to cyclical treatment of antibiotics. So what you see here is I start with a certain number of cells in this field of view. And then every time I send an antibiotic treatment, the yellow lines, then about 30% of the cells die every time. But then, similarly to earlier, if you actually stop and track a single cell that's alive now, back in time, you would find that all of its ancestor and mother and grandmother survived all of the treatments. Again, even then, even though they all had a 30% chance of dying every time, the one cell that's here, its ancestors survived all the treatments. So this is at the core of one of the aspects of my project, which says that, I guess, yeah, if you track it down, that says that the information about lineages is different than the ensemble average that you have, or the population average. And what I'm going to show you is that I can actually measure these differences and show that the lineage measurements and the population measurements can arrive to the same answer, but in totally two different ways. And you'll see that one of them is much more efficient than the other. And then typically, when you want to study single-cell biology in bacteria, like what I showed you here, you need to do these experiments where you look at one cell dividing over time. So it divides every 30 minutes. And then very rapidly, you can see it divide. And as you see here, you can do a lot of things with this system. You can track the gene expression. So in this case, you have green or red fluorescent proteins that track which gene are expressed. And you can see the fluorescence emitted by these cells. But then this type of approach has a few limitations. So first, you cannot really track the cells for more than about 10 generations. After 10 generations, cells grow exponentially, so they exponentially fast. They fill the whole field of view exponentially fast. Similarly, you cannot track many cells. You start with sparsely dispersed cells. You want to be able to track them for as long as possible, and don't want the microcolonies to go on top of each other. And similarly, you have severe control limitations. You cannot really change the environment once you start the experiment. The whole thing is encased in a block of agarose, which is kind of a gel-like structure, so you cannot really change the environment rapidly. So during my postdoc, I tried to resolve some of these issues, and to do that, I created this type of microfluidic device. So what you see here are cells, E. coli bacteria. They're growing inside these small chambers here. So the chamber is high enough just to allow a single cell to grow on a monolayer. And then we flow nutrients here in the main channel, and then the chambers are connected there. And as the cells grow, they push on each other. And then the cells that are here, they get washed away. But then you always have a fixed number of cells here that survive for a very long time. And if you are not bent on the details, it looks similar to the intestinal crypts that you have in your intestines. You have these crypts that are formed by our cells, but then you have some populations of cells that can live at the bottom here. So this is kind of a physiological equivalent of what I'm doing here. But then but bear in mind, just a comparison. It's not exactly what we're trying to reproduce. But nevertheless, this type of approach helps us to resolve a lot of the limitations that we had before. So again, we have this type of device, and it has two inputs. So you can actually track cells inside this device for a long time. You can also track many more populations in parallel because they're localized. So you can actually have different point of views with your microscope, and you can record a much higher number of cells over time. And also, you can change the environment. So because this is relatively small. These chambers are about 5 microns wide by 50 microns long. So at this scale, the flow dynamics are at low Reynolds number, so you can actually change the liquid inside or the media flowing very rapidly. So inside the main channel, there's a main flow of a medium. Then when you change it, it's only diffusion limited of how fast do you change what's happening in the chambers there. So in this case, I go from an environment that contains fluorescein molecules, which are first green in this case, and I remove the flow and replace it with just water, the ionized water, and then you find that within 10 seconds, you can actually change the environment. So this level of control on the environment is unprecedented. So you can actually change the whole environment in 10 seconds and then watch the effect immediately, how the cells respond to it. And then, and in addition to that, since we can actually do some image processing, we can track every single cell inside the device and track its position, its physiological property, its length or length or width, its gene expression level, as I showed you earlier, and how fast it divides, or how fast does it elongate or grow in size. And again, since we have total information about all the cells, we can actually recreate the whole pedigree or the whole lineage history of all the cells. Again, starting from a cell, we can know all of its sibling and grand siblings all the way back to the initial cell that was present inside the device. So by doing this, I use this approach, a combination of microfluidics and microbiology, to study how cells respond to fluctuating environments. And then I'll talk to you about three sub-projects of this, of what I've been doing. So I'm first going to describe fitness measurements that you can make inside these devices, and then also how bacteria process information, and then how do we interpret the extracellular signals that they are subjected to. And finally, I'll tell you about how cells actually interpret these signals to regulate gene expression and make cell fate decision making. So first of all, I'm going to talk to you about fitness measurements, how we use this device to do fitness measurements. So I'll start with a quote from François Jacob, which says that the dream of every cell is to become two cells. So if you have bacteria, whether it's in a wound, infection, or in a lake, or in your intestine, the default state is to grow, to divide. So you let it go. If everything is fine, it's going to divide. If it's stressed, or if there's anything that interferes with the cell division, then you know that something is wrong. So when you do that, we can actually look at a single cell here. This is its length over time. So it elongates. Then when it reaches a certain size, it divides. So there's a huge drop in length, so it's a 50% drop. So you can actually track it for many generations, again, hundreds of generations. But then you can also attach an age property to this cell. So between two divisions, every minute that goes by, you increase its age. So it's an artificial property that you do with analysis, but you can actually track its age over time. So you can actually use this information to infer any type of age-dependent growth or fitness effects that you see. Then when you do that, one of the main ways that you can characterize a age-structured population is to look at the age-dependent reproductive function. So basically, this is just this function here. It's just likelihood of observing a cell dividing at age X in the population. So in the case of human populations, it would just be the average, age-dependent fertility rate for women. But in bacteria, it's just the age-dependent division rate. How often do you observe cells dividing at a given age? And then I'll show you that, again, we can have population measurements, which looks at every individual's, every life event, every death event. And then you can extract this function with this approach. Or you can look at the lineage measurement, where you look at only a single cell and then analyze the properties of this lineage to extract the same information. So this second approach was a theoretical concept put forward by my postdoc supervisor, Ido Kossel. And then we're the first one to actually measure it and try to test it experimentally. And then to spice things up a little bit, if we were to leave cells in constant environments, then it would be a little bit boring. It would just divide at a given rate, and that's it. So what we do is that we subject the cells to antibiotic treatment, in this case carbinicillin, which interferes with cell wall synthesis. So basically, this molecule intercalates with this layer here, the peptidoglycan, and prevents it from polymerizing. So what happens is that the cell wall integrity is breached, and you would see this, the cells pop when you have, when they're subjected to these antibiotic treatments. And then this is an example of a few cells that, again, burst open whenever following an antibiotic treatment. So you would expect that cells would respond following each treatment, a fraction of the cells would die. And then the number of cells, the fraction of cells that would die would be dependent on how long you treat them. Since we can remove it really rapidly, we can tune how strong the treatment is by just having a short bursts of antibiotic treatments. So if we look at the population-wide measurement, the population-wide measurement of the reproductive function, it's simply the division rate times the survival rate. So there's a factor of 2 here because a cell divides into 2 individuals, so you have to account for that. But otherwise, these two properties, you can easily extract those from analyzing the data, and then this is what we did. We analyzed about 15,000 divisions, almost 7,000 lysis events, cells dying, and then you can extract a division age-dependent division probability, which looks something like that, and the survival probability also, which is age-dependent, which looks, I guess, something like the blue curve here. And if you combine these two, you have a reproductive function, the orange line that you see there. And then I'm going to go over some of the details of this function because it's kind of interesting. So first you have it's bimodal. You have 2 peaks that happens here. And if you compare this function, this is under antibiotic treatments, with the one that's without any antibiotic treatments, you find that the trough more or less coincides with the average, with the expected division time for a population without any antibiotic treatments. And what we find is that for a cell that survives an antibiotic treatment, this is here, there's a bar showing where the antibiotic treatment hits. A cell divides normally before the treatment, but following the treatment, there's a long period where it stops dividing. So there's a stress, it's stressed, antibiotic treatment interfered with the cell division machinery, so it doesn't divide until it can remove or clean out the antibiotic from the system, and then only once it's fresh to divide, then it does divide. So you have 2 type of division events, one that happens when it's not really affected by the antibiotics, and one when it's just following the antibiotics. So this corresponds to these 2 peaks that you see there. And then this peak here happens earlier because once it postponed, after it's postponed division for a long time, then it can divide rapidly in succession, like within 10 minutes, because it's so long and can divide much more rapidly. So, and also we can actually track the age-dependent lysis rate. So you find that as a cell gets older, the death rate increases by a factor of 3. So there's a strong age-dependent death rate. So as a cell, so we interpret this as being that the antibiotic affects cells, especially when they try to divide. So they're more sensitive when they try to divide. And this is what we see here. Once they pass the expected division age, then they are much more likely to divide or to die. Yes?
And with respect to age, as opposed
to size? Exactly. So we uncouple age and size. And then if we take length into account, or size, the effect is not there at all. So it's really age that's the main factor here. I mean, there's some correlation between length and age, but then we don't see this bimodality in length, because a short cell that's about to divide can still lyse, as opposed to a longer cell or young cell. So, all right. So this is one measurement that I'm doing. So again, I told you about this lineage approach. So we can actually do the same thing by looking at the lineage, and if we do that, again, we track a single cell. And if you look at this one carefully, following antibiotic treatments, a lot of its neighbor die, but then this one survives. So it gets elongated, it's behaving not as you expect it to, but it still survives every time. So you can track it back. And then to actually, what the surgical framework proposes is that you can analyze the age distribution of the cell along this surviving lineage. So the age distribution is similar to what you have following a US census. You have these age pyramid that tells you how many people are aged between 0 and 5, 5 and 10, etc. So this is a type of age distribution, but this is done at a fixed time. So it's as if I would look at the age distribution along a time here. But then what you want to look at is the age distribution along the lineage. So that would be equivalent to look at you, your parents, your grandparents, all the way back thousands of years, and look at how frequently do you get to age 1, 2, 3, 50, 80, 90 years old. So by having this distribution of ages, then you can use it to infer. Yes, I'm sorry, yeah.
Make sure I said surviving lineage here is surviving either death or just leaving the device.
Exactly. Exactly. So a lot of these cells here, they flow away. If there's no selection, 99% of the time cells flow away. There's only one that stays there. So this is a combination of both cell death and then flowing away. And earlier I showed you about the survival function. So this only considers surviving antibiotic treatments because getting washed away is kind of a random process that can affect any cell that's irrelevant of the age.
So does that mean that there's some kind of selection for people to stay in the tree?
Yeah. I'm going to actually touch upon on that later on. That's a good question. But yeah, there's geometry of the device also impinges strong selective pressures. So and in this case, cell death caused by the antibiotics, it's much, much stronger than some other selective forces that are happening. And then I'll actually go over that a little bit later on. So if you look at the lineage age distribution, it's actually different than the population or ensemble age distribution. So in this case, population is at a fixed time. And then lineage is along a surviving lineage. And then you find that the two distributions are different. And then we can exploit these differences to actually extract the selective forces that are acting on the population. And then from my supervisor's theory, it's the same reproductive function as we had earlier. You can derive it in a totally independent way and get presumably the same answer. So it's just here you take the derivative of this blue curve that you see here. Then you multiply it by a few factors that depend on the growth rate. But then the main way to extract it is, again, to take the derivative of this function. And if you compare what I had earlier, where I looked at thousands of divisions, death events, and also about 30,000 cells that were tracked over the whole experiment, you get a shape like this. But then if you do the lineage measurement, you just look at 18 single lineages for about 40 hours, about 10,000 division events and no death events, and you get the same information. So by tracking a cell that never died, you can actually know which one died otherwise. So this is a non-trivial result because you can actually extract information about the whole population by just looking at how a single cell survived or did not die in this case. So as I said earlier, you can see there's obvious differences between the two approaches. One of them is much more extensive. You track everything. But then the other one is much more precise, so you can actually extract information much more precisely, and that's a bit what I want to say. It's actually, in some cases, it could be more efficient to extract information about selection or evolutionary pressures by looking at lineages than to look at the whole population. And then this is actually an interesting point, because what I'm showing you is that you have a way to link the individual fitness or individual behavior to the population-wide growth rate. So as I showed earlier, you can have the infant mortality rate, which is an intrinsically information at the individual level. And then you can link it to the population-wide average. So in this case, decreasing the infant mortality rate has a clear effect on the growth rate of a country or of a population. But then it's not clear what the relationship should be. We should know it should be kind of proportional. So you decrease the infant mortality rate by a factor of 40, you would expect that the population would grow also at a faster rate. But it's not clear what the relationship should be. And then my supervisor theory showed that this proportionality constant is actually the surviving lineage distribution that I showed you earlier. So if I give a small example, you can have a fitness function that's constant regardless of the age of the individual. But then you can subject two populations at different ages to a small boost of fitness. So these two delta H's affect two populations at different ages. So young people, you decrease the mortality rate, or older people, you prolong their life after 80 years old. So you would find that the result of these two boosts in fitness on the population-wide growth rate will depend on the distribution. So in this case, you increasing the decreasing the infant mortality rate has a much higher effect on the population growth than, again, allowing older people to live longer. And you would see that there's a corresponding factor that increases the growth rate greater depending on the size of the population that's affected. So this is basically what this relationship tells you. I think these are intrinsically population-wide measurements. Yeah. So I'm not exactly familiar with all of the details.
The concept of the small change in mm-hmm. a particular age is something that people traditionally measure with sensitivity analyses of state structure, you know, as a matrix model for population growth.
Okay.
Is this the same output that you're getting?
I mean, the output, which would be the effect on the population growth, I would say, yeah, it's the same output. So again, if you have information about this distribution, then you can know a lot about the selection pressures or the selective force that act on the population. So and if you think about it, this is somewhat like how evolution works. So you can have a population that's fully adapted, so it grows at its maximal rate, it's adapted to its environment. However, following an environmental change, you can have that some individuals have a decrease in fitness if they possess a certain trait. But then this change of fitness will also affect the population growth. So the individual will have to evolve new traits to cope with this change, this environmental change. And then this fitness function would change to a new one. And then some cells will now be more adapted and spread within the population. And only once all the cells or the individuals spread this new trait in the population, you get back to a fully adapted population. So as a crude example, you can think of it as the one of the canonical example of evolution is the Galapagos Islands. You can have multiple ecosystems that differ between islands. So when a bird, for example, moves from one island to another, it may not be fully adapted to this new environment. So again, a beak that was adapted to eat seeds will need to be to evolve to eat insects, for example, if insects are more present in a different island. So this is the evolution of new traits that happens. And then once the beak morphology changes, then it would slowly fix and spread throughout the population, and eventually you would find that only changes with a certain beak shape will be found in some islands and not found in others. So that means that they closed up the loop and they became fully adapted to their environment. And then that also means that if you look at the lineage distribution, information that I can gather easily in my device or in my approach, then you can also know about the selective pressures. And I'm going to give you two examples. So the first one is if you look at the growth rate of the cells along the lineage, it's actually higher than the growth rate of the population average. So again, there's a distribution of division times that happens. So on average, some cells divide faster than others. There's an average time where the population divides, but then those that divide slightly faster, then they have more offspring, and they spread faster, and they have a higher likelihood to be present in the surviving lineage than cells which are just an average cell in the population. So again, if you compare this growth rate measurements with, in the case of antibiotics, then this effect disappears. So that tells you that this initial fitness boost, or this initial gain of fitness that was associated with a higher growth rate, totally disappears in the case of when you have antibiotic treatments, presumably because you have a much stronger selective pressures that kind of get rid of this effect. And then another example of this is, again, birth location, as someone raised earlier. If a cell is born here, it has a much, much higher chance of surviving, say, more than 30 minutes or more than a few hours than if it's born here, because it's going to get washed away right away. And if you look again at the distribution of a single cell that makes it for more than 60 hours inside the device, it's mostly localized here, and all of its offspring eventually move away. So again, birth location in this specific geometry is one of the strongest selective pressure you can get in the system. But once again, if you look at the same effect under antibiotic treatments, then the surviving cell is not necessarily confined here, like we see before. It's actually moving all around, because a lot of the cells die or are subjected to the antibiotic and die. So a cell that's born here may still have a high chance of surviving, because all of the other cells would die from a different cause. So again, this tells you that with antibiotic treatments, some of the earlier selective pressures are relaxed because of this this other selective pressure that happens. Yes, so it doesn't show it here, but it's actually two different environments. And then the one of them has no antibiotics, and the other one has a fixed concentration of antibiotics. So this doesn't change throughout the experiment. And then the time I expose the cells, it also doesn't change. So I expose them 20 minutes every 90 minutes, and I maintain that. I could change the regime if I wanted. Oh, yeah, you can actually look at what I showed earlier with fluorescent molecules, see how fast would a molecule diffuse inside. And again, within 10 seconds, you get that antibiotics or nutrient molecules actually diffuse all the way. And if you were to track the elongation rate or the growth rate as a function of position, there's no effect. It's pretty flat. So you can assume that throughout the chamber, the conditions are homogeneous. So you could think that if you have cyclical treatments that are repeated for hundreds, thousands, or millions of generations, then it would be beneficial for the cells to evolve kind of a mechanism to cope with these fluctuations. They could stop growing at a certain time, then only divide at certain other times in the case of antibiotics, and then that would allow them to survive, I guess, all antibiotic treatments. But then I couldn't quite do that. I had to share the microscope. But otherwise, you can have other systems which have this regular selective pressures that have been happening for millions of years. It's actually the Hertz rotation. So the many organisms are photosynthetic, and then light actually fluctuates with a regular 24-hour period. And many organisms have actually evolved circadian rhythms to anticipate and predict these cyclical variations. So in this case, I'll show that they have to interpret fluctuating signals. Again, the overall irradiance may be known, but then there's clouds that could happen. Some other events can change the actual light level. So cells have to interpret this information and process it to pick out the main 24-hour component. So again, I'll show that organisms develop circadian rhythm to cope and extract the main component of this fluctuation. This is the second part of my talk, where I talk about how cells process information to actually to make these optimally respond to the environment. So again, the organism I'm working with are cyanobacteria. So those are photosynthetic organism, and they contribute to actually 20 to 30% of the photosynthetic output of the Earth. So they are a huge component of oxygen production in the world, actually. And then what you see here on top of Lake Ontario, they often form these huge blooms, where some of these cells are cyanobacteria, some of them are algae, but all of them are photosynthetic, and then they respond in some nonlinear way sometimes and form these huge blooms. And the specific organism that I'm studying is Snococcus elongatus. Again, this is a cyanobacteria. It grows relatively slowly. It divides one every 8 to 12 hours, depending on the light levels. And what's interesting is that they only grow in the presence of light. So that means that they are phototropic autotroph. And then, as you can see here, they grow for a while, and then they stop as soon as I turn off the lights. And then they continue to grow again. And what's interesting, again, is that they developed a circadian rhythm, which is actually the simplest one in the animal kingdom. Humans, fungi, plants, they all have circadian rhythms. And then in the case of cyanobacteria, this is the simplest one that that people have found in nature. And it has these regular 24-hour cycles. And then what we can do is that we can use one of the genes that's driven by this circadian rhythm and attach it to, again, yellow fluorescent proteins and watch cells fluctuate in real time. And as you can see here, the clock is really regular. You can extract the period, and it's actually 24-hour pretty closely. And then it's self-running. It doesn't need to be driven by the environment. If you keep it in constant light, it's still going to run. If it, you keep it also in constant darkness, it's still going to run, but cells would die eventually, but it's still going to run. So it doesn't need external input to actually be maintained. And again, the system that's the circadian rhythm are happening because of three proteins that interact. The Chi ABC protein is actually a well understood molecular system. A lot of my current lab is working on understanding the biochemical aspect of the system, and I'm studying the in vivo aspect of this. And there's a question, I guess, that's lingering in many in circadian research is why would a cell or an organism develop a circadian rhythm? In the case of cyanobacteria, we can see there's two main scenarios that could explain why it could develop a circadian rhythm. So first, it could use its predictive power to anticipate light. So it could start producing and preparing to receive light, and as soon as light, more the sun rises, then it could be at a fitness advantage as opposed compared to the other. Or the other scenario could be that it could be used to anticipate darkness. Again, no food for 12 hours is pretty stressful, so they could have a way to build up reserves and then be prepared for this prolonged darkness. And then you would see that it's giving a stress protection advantage in this case. So it's not really, really clear which one is the most important a component of circadian research, and this is a question that I was attempting to answer. And to study this, I study how cells respond to a certain sudden pulses of darkness. So if a cell is happily fluctuating with a 24-hour cycle and you subject it to a dark pulse where you turn off the lights for a while, this resets or creates a phase shift on the actual circadian oscillation. And you can actually measure what the expected time would be compared to what you measure. So this phase shift can actually respond, can be represented in two different ways. So if you have a plot of the phase before the pulse and phase after, you can have either that the cells are not affected at all by this pulse, that is pretty robust. So you would see that all the cells, all the phases fall along this curve. So the phase before is the phase after, and there's no effect. On the other hand, if the perturbation is strong enough, then you will get to a point where all the phases are reset or synchronized to this pulse, and then you find that all the phase resetting will happen and fall along this line. So if I do that with individual cells, I can track and measure the phase before and after of hundreds of events, and you would find that the cells are mostly robust most of the time, except for a certain time where there's a phase shift here and they get reset by the environment. And if you look carefully, this corresponds to subjective noon, meaning that in the middle of the day is the time when the cells are most are less robust to these changes in light environments. I guess if it's during the night, they can expect prolonged darkness, so the clock is itself more robust. But then if it's during the day, then the phase is mostly reset after between subjective noon and subjective night. And then if you actually look at single cells that have their phase reset, you would find that there's a growth defect that happens. Again, if you track the cell, the length of some cells, they grow fine in the light. When it's dark, they stop growing totally, completely, and then they resume growth after the lights are turned back on. But then depending on what the phase was, when this dark pulse hits, this recovery is different. So in the case of cells that were hit during subjective night, then the recovery is very fast. It's almost as similar to what it was before. There's a small delay. But then if it's hit during subjective morning, then the recovery is much slower. So there's a growth, there's a fitness cost or a fitness defect that happens there. And if you tabulate it for all the different phases, you find that there's a kind of a shape, a curve that looks like that, meaning that the growth delay is higher during subjective day, when the dark pulse hits during subjective day, than when it hits during subjective night. And if you tabulate what the cumulative effect of this would be over many generations, you would find that, again, if you repeatedly hit cells with a dark pulse that happens earlier than what they anticipate, then there's a huge fitness cost. The survival rate goes way down. As opposed to when you hit it later, then the effect is much less pronounced. So cells are better adapted to survive when you hit the cell with the dark pulse later than they expect. So combining these two, this result, we kind of propose that the role of the clock is actually to anticipate darkness. Because if you hit it earlier than when it expects it, then there's a huge fitness cost than if they hit it later. So this is kind of a result that points in the direction that clock, in the case of cyanobacteria, are used to anticipate and prepare for a darkness. So there's also another aspect of information processing that happens in bacteria. There could be some situations where cells would actually want to pick up some higher frequency fluctuations and not be bothered by the longer range fluctuations. So in this case, this is an experiment that I've been doing where I show that the cells actually respond better to faster fluctuations. This is the third part of my talk. So in this case, this is work that's been published recently, and I study how cells interpret these fluctuating environments to actually behave and I guess make cell fate decisions. So again, starting from constant environments, cells may respond to a stimulus, and then there's many ways it can respond, and it can lead to different cell fate decisions. These stimulus could be varied. It could be temperature, pH, oxygen, sugar, or light, in the case of cyanobacteria. So cells have to actually tune their response to the type of fluctuations that they observe in the environment. And then in this case, I study E. coli bacteria, which is an enteric bacteria that lives in mammalian gut system. And then there's a known sequence of environments that a cell would find as it makes its way through the gut. So it would find a lower pH in the stomach, it would find a higher concentration of nutrients in the intestines and so on, and then the temperature will also change. So the cells also have evolved to respond to these cyclical or regular changes in environment. And in particular, they respond to sugar sources in an interesting way. So if you grow E. coli bacteria in the presence of many different sugars, one of those sugars is glucose, they would always consume glucose first before consuming the other sugars. So in the case of glucose lactose, the two sugars are present in equal quantities, but then cells, they only consume glucose, and then only when glucose is depleted would they express the gene and start necessary to catabolize lactose. And then following a certain lag phase, then they can grow on lactose again. And then this delay that happens is measured when you look at the total cell number over time. And this is, again, this is being theorized as being the time needed for the cells to actually express the genes necessary to consume the secondary sugar. So when you do this with glucose and lactose, this delay here is there because cells have to produce the gene necessary to consume lactose. And then if you look at the lac operon, which is the gene, the set of genes that need to be expressed to consume lactose, you see it has a inducible promoter, meaning that this responds only when lactose is present. And then it drives the expression of three different genes, lac-Z, lac-Y, and lac-A. And I'm going to briefly go over the function of each one. And so first, lac-Z. Its role is to break down lactose. So lactose needs to be broken down into simpler components to be able to be metabolized by the cells. But then, when the lactose is broken down, it also some inducer molecules are produced, and these inducer molecules increase the expression of the lac operon. So this is kind of a feedback loop that happens here. So lac-Z contributes to the production of inducer molecules that drive its own expression higher. So the second gene, lac-Y, is a pump that imports lactose. So it sits on the surface of the cells and then imports lactose molecules inside the cell for the cells to consume. So again, the presence of these pumps creates a positive feedback because now you can import more lactose and grow more rapidly. So there's a second feedback loop that happens here. And then finally, lac-A, which is a third gene, that its role is not really well understood, but then it's kind of theorized that it's useful for cell detoxification, but then it doesn't involve any, create any feedback. Whether you can remove this gene and the cells would be perfectly happy. So now we want to recreate this example inside my microfluidic device. Oh, and sorry, and again, glucose is kind of a master repressor. So the presence of glucose shuts down the expression of this lac operon completely. So the presence of glucose can prevent all of this to happen. So this is why you have these two curves here. So when you actually do these experiments inside the device, cells grow under lactose conditions, and then glucose conditions, and we switch to lactose. So they stop growing for a while and slowly recover. So you can look at the relative growth rate before the cells grow happily. When you switch to lactose, there's a lag phase of about 30 minutes where there's no growth at all. Cells are still alive, but they just don't elongate and grow. And then they slowly recover and reach a stable growth rate again. So this kind of confirms what we had earlier. There's a prioritization of the glucose source that's being consumed. But then we try to see what happens when you fluctuate the environment. So again, you start with glucose, you have lactose, there's a lag phase. Cells recover, grow again. Then you reintroduce glucose again. So now, when we reintroduce lactose, what's going to happen? Will it go through a lag phase again, or will it continue growing as if nothing happens, or will it do something in between? I guess take a mental note, try to guess what's going to happen. And then what's happening is nothing. Cells actually are still able to grow under lactose conditions. So they remember the previous adaptation, this in this case 4 hours after lactose has been removed. So to go at the root of this phenomenon, we actually use, again, yellow fluorescent protein to track the protein levels of the lac protein levels, the number of lac Z, lac Y, and lac A inside the cells. So again, if you start from a fully induced population that grows under lactose and you remove lactose, then the protein level decreases. It decays exponentially, actually. And then only when lactose is reintroduced will it start to go down, go up again. But then the decay constant is actually pretty long. It's equal to the division rate. So that means that the lifetime of these proteins, the pump or the enzyme that cleaves lactose, is extremely long. It doesn't get degraded by any external mechanism. It just gets transmitted from mother to daughter during divisions. So that means that when you fluctuate rapidly, then the levels never go down to zero. So you always have the protein number is not maximal, but it's still enough to allow the cells to bypass the lag phase. And we call this phenotypic memory. It's kind of a transmission of the phenotype between generations, but it's not genetic in nature. It's just the way that cell content is transmitted between generations. And we wanted to see which of these three proteins was responsible for this memory that we observe. And then again, if we have a synthetic gene construct that overexpresses only one of the three genes in the lac operon, either lac Z, lac Y, or lac A, and then we tracked to see if there's a lag phase or a delay in growth when we switch from glucose to lactose. And then by doing that, we find that only lac Z, the one that cleaves lactose and creates inducer molecules, allows the cells to bypass the lag phase. Otherwise, if you have many pumps, you still have the cells still go through a lag phase and recover. The recovery is faster, but they still go through a lag phase. And then a lot of lac A actually messes up their metabolism, and they don't grow that well at all. So again, so we identify that lac Z is the important molecule that allows cells to remember previous adaptation to lactose. And then, interestingly, if we subject cells only to a short pulse of lactose, we can track again the protein levels. We find that the protein level peaks about 30 minutes after we remove lactose. So cells continue to produce lac proteins, even though there's no lactose around. So, and then we found that this effect is due to the feedback loops that are built into the system. So there's a kind of a sustained expression that's caused by having a feedback that happens like that. And if you actually look at what happens when you have native feedback, meaning that this is the wild type or the typical way a cell responds to a pulse of lactose, and you compare it with the response when you have synthetic molecules that still trigger the expression of a lac operon, but that cannot be metabolized or important, you would find that this sustained expression dies off much more rapidly. But this is a weird system because the network itself could respond much more rapidly than what we observe. And here, there's actually about 20 minutes of unnecessary protein productions. This could have a huge effect on the fitness or on the function of the cells, because they produce proteins or stuff that they don't need, actually. So to understand why, to understand this phenomenon, we actually look at the induction or under fast fluctuations. So again, if you have no feedback, you would expect that production, the lac protein levels would decrease immediately after you remove lactose, but then what we observe is that it increases. So there's a different level when at the end of this 200 minutes when you have native feedback or no feedback. But then this is actually useful, because the difference you have here tells you that there's more activity. Cells can actually consume lactose at a much more at the level that's higher when their lac levels is here than when it's there. So this additional activity allows them to respond faster. And then in this case, if you look at the total number of lactose molecules that are consumed, depending on the fluctuation time, how rapidly the environment fluctuates, you would find that between about, one hundredth of a generation to maybe two generations, then you consume a lot more lactose molecules if you have kind of this delay built into your regulatory network, as opposed to no feedback. If the environment changes slowly, then there's no real fitness advantage. If it changes rapidly, then there's no real fitness advantage. But then the existing lacopron is kind of tuned to respond optimally to fast fluctuations. This is what you see here. So to conclude, I think I'm going to conclude with another quote from François Cobb, is evolution is a tinkerer. So there's no general design principles between what we observe. It's always cells evolve, they change their environment, they change their regulatory network, but then they find the best way possible to do something, and then this kind of propagates. But it's not a purpose. There's no grand design behind it. But then you can all, but still, if you use tools from physics or biology or mathematical tools, you can kind of extract how cells actually reached this final state, and how what was the rationale between evolving some type of regulation network as opposed to some other type that may be less efficient. So again, by tracking the total life history or the way that cells respond to given environments, then you can understand why some networks or some cells behave better in some ways than in others. So to conclude, I want to thank my sources of fundings and the research laboratories where this research has been happening, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Okay.
Going all the way to the beginning, can you tell us a little more about the difference between your microfluidic system and, say, blood machine that
you use? Mm-hmm. So it's based on the same principle. So to put people up to speed, there's a mother machine that's a similar type of device where cells only grow. The chamber is only wide enough for one cell. So I can actually create those devices, and I have them on the same chip, if you want, but then I chose to look at these environments because the problem with the mother machine is that sometimes you have cells that behave badly. So you have some cells that elongate, like this one, or sometimes they form kind of a weird morphology, and this, like this one here, it's a three-pronged weird thing. So when you have a single cell, then if this happens, then you can lose the population. So there's no robustness to these type of morphological defects. So in this case, it's slightly wider, so it's much more robust to these. And we can actually study them in more precisely, because there's some space that allows some of these other physiological events from happening, like this one again. And then this is the first one, and the second one is, again, being able to change the environment rapidly. This is, I think, again, something that could be done also with different type of devices, but then this is, my paper is the first one that explored this effect, that you can actually change it very, very rapidly. So a lot of theories deal with fluctuating environments, and this is one of the first realization, at least in bacteria, of a fluctuating environment. So this is a huge advantage if you want to study these type of questions. So actually, this is from the same data set. So I actually do track everybody, everything. And then I have all these little lineages, all the long ones. But then I only analyze a small subset of this information to get the same measurement than what I would get by analyzing, again, thousands of cells. So it could be that someone, I mean, you could hire a undergrad to look at one cell over time and track how often does it divide. What does it play? You can, I mean, now I did all the analysis, but then you could take a shortcut now that we know it works, and then you can only track this one cell and have someone sit here and detect when it divides and not care about 99.9% of the population and still get the same result. So in my case, it's inefficient because I do both, and I do a lot of work to reach both conclusions. But then now that we kind of show that it could work, I could extract the same information by just, again, tracking this one cell.
Now, speaking of the same versus different information, now, Chris, it's another point you mentioned that thickness measured along the lineage is a little bit higher, which is sort of exactly what you expect if you have some distribution in this population. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the answer whether the measurements are the same or different actually depends on what question you ask.
Yeah. So.
So how do I know what to expect unless I already know the answer?
So. I feel that in both cases, I mean, in this case, you have different measurements. And one of them tells you about this population. It tells you, okay, this population grows at this rate, and that's it. But then if you look at the lineage, you first get, okay, then some cells that grow slightly faster are more advantageous. But now if you look at this lineage, you can actually extract with this type of relationship, something that you can't really extract if you look at the population-wide properties. So again, this, if you want to know what the relationship between population growth and individual fitness, then you have to look at this lineage distribution. Maybe the other sensitivity measurements look at the population-wide response, but then in this case, by measuring this, then you can know exactly, you have a much more higher predictive power than to look at everything else. Okay. Yeah, so.
They still maintain a
24-hour cycle. But then, actually, it's not really known what happens in the real world where you have, again, 8 hours of light and 16 hours of darkness. Presumably, they don't grow as well because it may be colder. But then there's always a phase locking, as you said, with the environment. So if you have two populations and you can have mutants that have a 28-hour clock as opposed to 24, and then you mix those two populations and subject them to a 28-hour day, then you would find that the clock that matches the environment survives better than the one that has a mismatched clock. Same thing if you were to submit the same environment, same population to a 24-hour cycle. So in theory, there's some self-selection that happens where the environment is tuned to the actual the expression level is tuned to the environment. Funny thing, the Earth's rotation, it changed. It was much faster a billion years ago, and we had the same cyanobacteria in the same gene, more or less, but then they responded to a 22 or 21-hour cycle as opposed to 24. So it's somewhat easy to deviate from this 24-hour cycle, and then I feel there might be some phase locking that happens continuously because of that. Yes?
Could you go back to that part?
Okay. And which one? Sorry. Yeah. No, that's right. It may not be representative, but then this one dies off pretty quickly afterwards. Mainly, if I have the complete one, which is a little bit more extensive, that doesn't track anyone in particular. I have an image here. Then most of the surviving lineage sit along the top branch here. Even though you have secondary ones here, I guess the way phylogeny, I mean, the way you plot it, you make it so that it's always there's one dominant one.
No, a quick question also. The image analysis, you track the surviving descendant, you track that backwards in time.
Exactly. It's much, yeah. Once you have, you still have to know who divides when and then who are its daughter, but then once you have that, it's easy to track back the lineage. Or the descendants, for that matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's some dyes that actually look at cell physiology or metabolic output. We haven't done those tests. In the case of when you have antibiotic when you treat cells with antibiotics, they burst open, so it's pretty easy to see when they die. But then even in the absence of selection, you still or antibiotics, you still have some cells which stop growing. And I guess this is called a persistence. So cells enter a dormant state to survive antibiotic treatments, and then randomly kind of wake up again. So they don't grow, but they're still alive, I guess. But then they're not sensitive to the antibiotics. So there's a few of those events that we observe in the device when we treat them regularly. But then it's not something that's a significant survival strategy, because the environment changes so rapidly that waking up will make you as sensitive as someone else. So yes. You mean the lag levels between foreign divisions? So we didn't see any strong effect, but then that's because we have a really high level of lactose. Then we remove it completely. But then if you have an intermediate, you can get to a point where you have a branching between two populations that consume lactose and some others that don't. So we were not at that level. We kept the levels pretty high to make sure that all the cells are induced 100%.
And my second question is, what we're studying are about growing cells. Mm-hmm. Not the response in recovery after starvation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so actually, whether the proteins will remain intact and be transmitted, actually, we don't know. It may be that the cells now would get degrade, the proteins would get degraded to be used for some other things. But it's actually a good idea, but we haven't tested that.
Final question about the pseudococcus. If diatom, there is a separation of and light assimilation. So that only the dark, they are efficient in taking off nitrate, for instance. So I suppose you have different costs of different environment and only have the variation. So if light being cut off.
Exactly.
What do you think would happen if you also put things together, you fluctuate the nitrate and you in phase or out phase for light?
Yeah. So I mean, nitrate could be one, but then there's a what my current lab is pursuing is trying to see if ATP levels have an effect on the clock. So again, this clock is three proteins. It's easy to understand, and you can actually recreate it in a test tube. You put it in a test tube, and it oscillates by itself. But then in the test tube, we can actually see that the ATP levels kind of reset the clock the same way that a dog pulse resets it. So we could imagine fluctuating glucose or some other type of ATP-producing, some other type of chemical that can allow the ATP levels to fluctuate and couple that with the light environment. But yeah, I haven't. That's right. So one of the main line of experiment that my lab is doing is again trying to prove that ATP levels is one of the main driver of this phase resetting curve that we see. Yeah, that's what we think. We actually did some bulk experiment where we have two flasks and then fluctuate glucose with a 24-hour period, with a 12-hour cycle as opposed to light. And then we see that they are synchronized with this feeding pattern. So, but we haven't done it at the single cell level.
All right, well, so if there are any additional questions, there are still spaces on the schedule that need to be filled. So if you would like some more time with
Guillaume, yes.
Guillaume. Thank you. There's time available, so I want to stop by and by thanking Guillaume for.